Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus, who examines how a change in U.S. policy could reduce rising tensions resulting from North Korea's recent nuclear weapons test. Hudson Riverkeeper Alex Matheson, who assesses the economic and environmental benefits of the EPA's large-scale Hudson River PCB dredging project. And retired auto worker and UAW union member Frank Hammer, who talks about his view of the General Motors bankruptcy, a company where he worked for 32 years. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Newly declassified Swedish diplomatic notes show the length Chinese authorities are willing to go to marginalize Uyghur prisoners who are held at the U.S. Guantanamo Bay Detention Center and cleared of all charges. The 17 Uyghur prisoners belong to the largest Muslim minority group in western China. Beijing has branded them as terrorists. One of the Uyghur detainees, Hakim Gan, was released from Guantanamo in 2006 and recently granted political asylum in Sweden. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the memo showed the Chinese questioning Swedish motives, accusing the Scandinavian country of giving protection to a terrorist. Beijing is seeking to try the Uyghur prisoners in China, even though they have been cleared of any wrongdoing by American officials. This has put added pressure on U.S. Attorney Eric Holder's attempts to close down Guantanamo. Germany is supportive of a plan to accept 9 Uyghur prisoners, and 7 other Uyghurs could be resettled in the United States. Thomas Hammerberg, the Council of Europe's Commissioner for Human Rights, noted, U.S. authorities have the primary responsibility for correcting the damage they brought against the prisoners and should offer them permits to stay. However, European countries should be prepared to receive some of these wrongly detained people as well. Guatemala's left-leaning president Alvaro Colom has been implicated in the murder of prominent lawyer Rodrigo Rosenberg, energizing the right wing that has long run the poor Central American country under a succession of dictators. Days after Rosenberg's murder on May 10th, the lawyer was shown in a video that Rosenberg had recorded a few days before his death. He accused President Colom and his chief aide Gustavo Olejos of orchestrating his murder. Colom claims he is innocent. Colom, the first left-leaning president since the 1954 CIA coup that overthrew Jacobo Arbenz, blames the right wing for mobilizing mass protests against him and pressuring him to resign. Tens of thousands of poor and indigenous people have also marched in support of Colom, who has boosted job creation and social programs. To the dismay of former military officers, Colom has agreed to open the police archive, revealing details on how political dissidents were abducted and killed during the 36-year Civil War. Colom points out that the two men who helped record the video of Rosenberg's accusations have been involved in earlier political coups, including television journalist Mario David Garcia, who was taken off the air in 1988 to stop rogue colonels from using his program to announce a coup that later failed. In the midst of last year's economic crash, Russell Athletic, a division of Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway Company, closed the only unionized garment factory in Honduras. In response, American sweatshop activists have convinced 25 universities to drop licensing deals with Russell Athletic, including high-profile institutions like the University of Michigan, Penn State University, the University of Miami, and Harvard University. The Workers' Rights Consortium, a labor monitor backed by universities, issued a report calling the closing of the Jerseys de Honduras factory the culmination of a long anti-union campaign. The consortium blasted Russell Athletic's tactics as the scorched earth option. In 2007, the Labor Rights Monitor accused Russell Athletic of firing 145 workers at the factory for exercising their right to organize. Russell claims it pays wages 26% above the minimum wage and provides employees with health insurance and vacations. In its rebuttal, the Worker Rights Consortium says the factory only offered the pay and benefits required by Honduran law. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Emily Santos-Poplowski.
In the wake of seismic evidence that North Korea successfully conducted its second nuclear weapons test since 2006 on May 25th, the U.S., South Korea, and China condemned the action. The government in Pyongyang followed the underground nuclear detonation by launching 5 short-range missiles. In a harsh reaction to the criticism, the North renounced the truce in place since the Korean War ended in 1953 and asserted that any foreign power that boarded its ships searching for nuclear material would constitute an act of war. As U.S. President Barack Obama and South Korea's conservative leader Lee Myung-bak urged the U.N. Security Council to impose tough new sanctions against the North, a Seoul newspaper reported that the government of Kim Jong-il was preparing to test-fire his nation's most sophisticated long-range ballistic missile. Speculation that the North's actions were tied to a succession struggle within the secretive communist state were fueled by reports that Kim Jong-il had suffered a serious stroke in August. South Korean news outlets now maintain that the North's leader has chosen his youngest son, Kim Jong-un, to succeed him in power. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus and former Pan Tech Fellow in Korean Studies at Stanford University, who examines how a change in U.S. policy could reduce rising tensions in the Korean Peninsula resulting from the North's recent nuclear weapons test.
North Korea tested a nuclear device for the first time in 2006. And after that test, many people, many experts, declared the test a dud. And I think that the first priority for North Korea is to dispel any kind of doubts that it has a viable nuclear program. To be honest with you, though, we still don't know the capabilities that North Korea has. Don't know if it, you know, can actually miniaturize a nuclear weapon, deliver a nuclear weapon, etc. Nonetheless, I think this is priority number one for a country that is largely surrounded by adversaries and which is in a pretty lousy economic situation. The second reason, I think, is that it wanted to get the attention of the Obama administration. North Korea is pretty much fixated on the United States and getting U.S. attention. It believes the United States holds the key to any kind of solution on the Korean Peninsula for it. And it wasn't getting a lot of attention from the Obama administration. And, you know, Obama comes into office, he has a lot of things to do. He's got a big domestic agenda, and of course his foreign policy plate is pretty full too, with a global economic crisis, climate change, Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, etc. North Korea wasn't very high on the priority list. So I think that was the other kind of major message. And then just quickly, the third one would be China. China reacted very negatively to North Korea's first nuclear test and to North Korea's rocket launch in April. And I think North Korea wanted to say, hey, you know, we are not China's pawn. We do what we want to do and not what Beijing tells us to do.
As you describe the motivation for this, is it safe to say that Kim Jong-il is not crazy?
I would say he's not crazy. I would say he's in a very, shall we say, weak position. And that dictates the logic of his actions. He has seen that countries that don't have deterrent capabilities have been either invaded or destabilized in some other way, and that's a concern he has. I mean, there are not a lot of countries of his variety left in the world, and he is quite isolated in Northeast Asia. Obviously, South Korea has become one of the most prosperous countries in the world. Japan, very prosperous. China, also major economy and has drifted quite far apart from North Korea. Russia, no longer as close an ally as it used to be. So basically, Kim Jong-il has to make decisions based on weakness. And that has dictated, I think, the decision to go forward with the nuclear program. Remember, North and South Korea used to be relatively equal in terms of their military capabilities, their economic status. In the mid-70s or so, they started to diverge. Today, North Korea spends about $500 million a year on its military budget. South Korea alone spends about 40 times that amount. So if you're in North Korea and you're looking across the border at a country that's outspending you every year by 40 times, and then you add in U.S. military and Japanese military, you have to ask yourself, well, what can we do to even the playing field? Well, logically speaking, that means going for a weapon of mass destruction.
Where do you think the Obama administration's policy is headed regarding North Korea? And if you were to advise the president on shaping his policy in maybe a different direction than past presidents, what would you tell him?
Well, I'm waiting for the phone call. But if I do get that phone call, I would say, you know, the current policy is not the right direction for the United States. I certainly understand that the Obama administration has a lot of other priorities and that North Korea is not a particularly high priority. Second, I understand why it's not a particularly good time to reach out a hand of friendship to North Korea after it's tested a nuclear weapon and engaged in rather hostile rhetoric. That could, of course, let off a firestorm of conservative criticism here in the United States of the Obama administration. So I understand the difficulties of approaching this issue. However, I think that right now we have a very small window of opportunity before North Korea, you know, has its nuclear program back up and running rather significantly. And I think that we need to send an envoy to Pyongyang sooner rather than later. That envoy could address a different issue at first rather than the nuclear issue, could address the issue, for instance, of the two detained journalists, American journalists who are in North Korea after North Korea basically arrested them, accused them of violating North Korea's borders by coming in through China. An envoy could go over and talk about that issue, and that could break the ice, could lead to perhaps more quiet discussions about the nuclear program. I don't think we really have much of a choice. The military option's off the table. I think neglecting North Korea has, in the past, simply led to North Korea developing a more robust nuclear program and engaging in provocative behavior. Only through engagement have we managed to basically put a cap on North Korea's nuclear program, freezing it in the 1990s during the agreed framework period, and then leading to a 70-80% dismantlement of the Yongbyon facility in the last couple years of the Bush administration. I think those are the examples that are in front of us. It's just a question of when we decide to go back to the table. I think we should do it sooner rather than later.
That was John Pfeffer, co-director of Foreign Policy in Focus. Read his articles online at fpif.org or at his website, johnpfeffer.com. For years, General Electric discharged wastewater containing polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, which were used as lubricants and coolants, into the Hudson River from two of its New York State plants. PCBs were banned in 1977 when research revealed that it was a probable human carcinogen and linked to immune, reproductive, and nervous system disorders. Residents and activists along the Hudson River fought for more than 30 years to force GE to clean up its mess. And on May 15th, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency initiated the largest Superfund cleanup in its history, dredging a 40-mile stretch of the river to be overseen and paid for by GE. But the company has not yet committed to undertaking a second, bigger phase. The dredged materials will be treated and then trucked to a landfill in Texas, a plan which some residents and environmentalists have criticized. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Alex Matheson, president of Riverkeeper, an independent environmental group, about the scope of the PCB dredging project and the expected economic and environmental benefits.
Riverkeeper was the first organization on the Hudson to address this issue. Our founder, Bob Boyle, was the first to make the link in the early 1970s between the PCBs that were being discharged from General Electric's capacitor facilities up in Fort Edward and Hudson Falls, north of Albany, and the PCB-contaminated fish downstream here in the Hudson River estuary. So we were part of the effort to get PCBs banned and to force General Electric to close down those facilities back in the mid-70s, and we've been fighting ever since to get them to undertake a comprehensive cleanup of the PCBs, which essentially means to remove the PCBs from the river through a dredging process. We've been working on this for about 30 years. The fact that General Electric has just started the cleanup as of 2 weeks ago is very welcome news and long overdue.
Now, I've read about this particular situation and also other situations where bad things settle in water bodies, and sometimes it seems to make sense not to remove them. And I was reading some reasons why in the Hudson River it made sense that they should be removed. But what's the downside to dredging?
You know what? They're really, on net, there is no downside to dredging in terms of cleaning the river itself. There's no question that removing these materials, dredging these materials, is from an environmental standpoint far superior than just leaving them in the river, despite what General Electric spent well over $100 million in a propaganda campaign convincing the public of. The EPA did an 11-year exhaustive scientific and legal study of the Hudson River PCB problem with the support of five independent scientific panels, concluded that the only solution was to remove the PCBs from the Hudson River through dredging. Unfortunately, in my 9 years at Riverkeeper, I have still to meet a single person, no matter how well educated, no matter how well informed, no matter how environmentally conscious, who has not said to me, isn't it better just to leave them in the river, which is a testament to General Electric's very slick advertising propaganda campaign. But the bottom line is that dredging is the way to go. Now, are there side effects, if you will, from dredging? Of course. The dredging project will be underway 6 days of the week, 24 hours a day, for in the first phase about 6 months, and then for about 6 to 8 months every year for another 4 or 5 years after that. So it's a very big project. It's the largest Superfund cleanup project in the history of the United States. It will have some noise impacts on the local communities. There will be some additional truck traffic going through the area. There will be quite a lot of activity on the river itself, that 40-mile stretch, which will be, you know, if nothing else, a nuisance to boaters and so on. Don't have to listen to it or go by it. But the good news is that this project, which will cost General Electric over $1 billion, that's billion with a B, possibly closer to $1.5 billion or more, by the time they're done, will be a source of great economic stimulation to the local community. They're going to be creating 500 jobs during the cleanup. And that, of course, translates into apartments being rented, restaurants being patronized. So it's going to be a real economic boon to the local community, even though they are going to have to put up with some disturbance during the cleanup. But at the end of the day, or at the end of this five-year cleanup period, these communities will have returned to them a much cleaner river. And that allows them to remove the blight of the PCBs that have stained the communities for, you know, over 30 years. They have taken great pains to design a project that will minimize the amount of PCBs that are resuspended in the water column and that would then travel downstream into the lower estuary. Keep in mind that before the dredging project started, the status quo means that about 500 pounds of PCBs are getting stirred up from that upper 40-mile stretch and coming over the dam at Troy every year and continuing to contaminate the lower part of the Hudson. And that's what's kept PCB levels in many fish at levels that are above EPA and FDA standards, so which is essentially why many of the commercial fisheries are still closed. So the whole idea behind this dredging project is once you remove the majority of PCBs from that 40-mile stretch, you essentially remove the source of PCBs for the estuary, for the lower Hudson. Once you do that, then PCB levels of fish, which have been declining over the last 30 years but then plateaued in the 1990s, can then continue to decline to the point where they get below FDA and EPA levels, and we can conceivably reopen some of these fisheries over time.
That was Alex Matheson, Hudson Riverkeeper and president of the Independent Environmental Organization. Contact Riverkeeper by calling area code 914-478-4501. Or visit the group's website at riverkeeper.org. The nation's largest manufacturer, General Motors, filed for bankruptcy on June 1st, making it one of the biggest corporate failures in U.S. history. With $50 billion in financing from the government thus far, the company will continue to operate while reorganizing under Chapter 11 of the United States Bankruptcy Code, allowing the company to sell off its assets, restructure debt, close plants, and terminate contracts. After filing for bankruptcy, GM announced it would close 14 more of its U.S. factories, lay off as many as 21,000 more employees, and close 1,100 dealerships. The carmaker will emerge from its current crisis with less than 40,000 U.S. workers, a dramatic decline from the 395,000 employees that once worked for the automaker during the 1970s. Michigan, where GM is based, is particularly hard hit. After the restructuring, American taxpayers will own a 60% stake in the company, and the United Auto Workers Union Health Care Fund will own a 17.5% share of GM. The rest will be divided among GM's bondholders and the Canadian and Ontario governments. As part of its mandated downsizing, GM's Hummer division will be sold to a Chinese company, and talks are underway with potential buyers for its Saturn brand. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with retired auto worker and past UAW Union Local 909 president Frank Hammer, who talks about the pain and opportunities he sees in General Motors bankruptcy, a company where he worked for 32 years.
The unthinkable is what's happening, and certainly it makes me wonder what we think is unthinkable today that might happen 5 years from now or 2 years from now. We're talking about the bankruptcy of the largest company in the world and certainly the largest auto manufacturer up till last year. So it's quite a shocking event. The second thing that's really shocking about it is that this crisis that has unfolded is really shaping up to sort of be a perfect storm, certainly in the city of Detroit and most of the auto-based towns, has also been targeting the remaining union, the powerful union in the United States of manufacturing, and it's really practically the death knell of the UAW as we've known it. And it's really a culmination of 20 years of debilitating blows against our union, and I think this is sort of the final blow, and it's almost scripted that the UAW will no longer be able to exceed standards set by non-union factories in the South. And that's actually in language.
Frank, as it was apparent that this latest economic downturn, this severe recession, was going to take such a toll on GM, Chrysler, and to a lesser extent Ford, there was a debate in Congress as the Bush administration was exiting the scene and Obama was coming in about what to do. There were many conservative politicians who said, do nothing, let it die, let it fall where it's going to fall. And then, of course, Obama was an advocate of pouring in some billions of dollars to keep GM, particularly, and Chrysler, too, afloat until these accommodations for bankruptcy could be met. Was there an alternative way you think this could have been handled with better prospects for employees and their families?
The senators you're talking about, which were these Republicans in the southern states like Corker and Shelby, they were stipulating various demands that basically the UAW matched the terms of the southern non-union transplants. They made a lot of noise. There was a lot of fanfare. Bush, at the end, conceded to giving a bridge loan. And then when Obama stepped in, he actually upped the conditions that were originally set out by the Republican senators and actually demanded greater sacrifices and greater concessions from the UAW than even Shelby and Corker were. So it was really staggering to see how seamless this was and how different Obama's approach was from appearing under the previous administration. In response to specifically to your question, this is a time for big thinking. I think Obama spoke about that in his campaign leading up to his successful election. The big thinking in this case would have been not going into the reorganization of a Chrysler, not going into the reorganization of GM as automobile companies, rather taking a whole new look at a whole transportation industry and developing a new industrial policy for a redefined transportation industry that would include expedited development of rapid transit, of cleaner mass transit systems. And I think that that opportunity maybe was talked about, but if you look at the details of the proceedings up to date, there really is no view currently of doing that. So all we're ending up doing is salvaging the brand of GM, but in the meantime, we're shuttering 14 plants, 11 to be closed permanently, 3 to be idled, with 21,000 more workers out on the streets.
What role do you think the failure of the United States to have comprehensive health care for all Americans played in the demise of General Motors? And where do you think we need to move now with regard to reforming our health care system in this country?
I think that it's one of the pivotal issues that helped to bring this crisis about. The UAW was never for the idea of employer-based health care. In the 50s, it argued for national health care. It lost that argument, and now we're reaping the results of company employer-based health care. In 2005, the UAW and GM both recognized the problem that health care costs were causing for the Big Three and for GM specifically, and they parties mutually agreed to pursue a national health care solution, citing Canada as a possible model. And though they made that agreement on a piece of paper, signed letter, the whole thing, they both walked away from that agreement and never pursued it. I think we'd be much further ahead in the struggle for health care reform in the United States had GM and the UAW done what they said they would do, and that is to lobby and to build coalitions for health care reform. We would be much further ahead than we are now, and we maybe would have saved GM from going into bankruptcy as they have done.
That was Frank Hammer, retired 32-year General Motors employee and former president of UAW Local 909 in Michigan. For more information on the organizing project of union auto workers and their allies, visit the website autoworkercaravan.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Emily Santos-Poplowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.